Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'd like to call this meeting to order. I don't know. The red light's on. Good afternoon, everybody. You have to get up close. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Townsend, and I want to call this meeting to order, please. We're glad to see everybody here.
Hi, Bill.
Stephanie, would you call the roll, please?
Pastor Bergson.
Here.
Island Danaby.
Here.
Bill Gleason.
Here.
Ernie Gullerud.
Here.
Dolores Henry. Mike McClellan. Tom Moore.
Here.
Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Deborah Townsend.
Here. Thank you. You may not know, but Dolores Henry is out of town and can't be here tonight, so I'm in her place tonight, this afternoon. Is there citizen input? Yes. Oh, Darlene, thank you so much. It sounds like you're off to a wonderful start. Congratulations. Yeah, thanks. Is there other citizen? That, you know, that's a hard act to follow, but I'd welcome. All right. Is there CCDDB information? Peter?
Yeah, just a couple of things. Champaign County Developmental Disabilities Board met this morning. This was our first meeting with the new five-member board, so we introduced the new board members. Michael Smith was elected secretary. We somehow had neglected to do that at the July meeting, or elect a secretary. And then the other thing I want to mention is that the Developmental Disabilities Board is planning to have a retreat in January, probably January 25th, and obviously, you know, anybody from this board that has an interest in developmental disabilities that would like to participate can participate. But the intent is to invite providers and stakeholders and anybody that you know has an interest in these services to participate. And of course, it will be a posted meeting, so the public. Anybody from the public would be welcome to come. We do not have a location or an agenda at this point, but the idea is to try to get some additional input before we get into the funding decisions for FY15.
Thank you. You'll turn to your minutes from the last meeting, and I welcome a motion to approve. Thank you, Tom. Is there a second? Island, thank you. Moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Yes, Julian.
If you look at the very beginning there, it says staff excused. Is that the board excused?
Oops. Yes.
Unless you guys have new jobs.
No, I haven't gotten a paycheck anyway. So it's just a. Stephanie, if you just change that. Yeah, thanks. Any other comments? Questions? Okay, all in favor of approving these minutes, please say aye. Any opposed? The same. Minutes are approved. Thank you. I don't have any comments. Oh, more's the pity. Oh, well. But I bet Pete, what?
That's the first.
It's a first, yes. Enjoy.
The start of a trend?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay, I'm just. Okay.
I'm sure Peter has some comments, though.
Just a couple. I think we, in September, we had on the 18th a public hearing, and I thought it turned out very well. I want to thank all the board members from this board and the Developmental Disabilities Board who came and participated. I'd like to remind everybody that even though we have a separate Developmental Disability Board and a Mental Health Board, they do have an overlapping responsibility in the area of intellectual disabilities and developmental disabilities. And that's why we have an intergovernmental agreement between the two boards, and that's why it specifies the financial commitment that this board has to intellectual disabilities and developmental disabilities. So it's probably a good idea if you haven't seen it. I believe it's posted online. Take a look at the intergovernmental agreement. It'll give you a better understanding of the why these two boards, it's important for them to coordinate and to do integrated planning. The other thing I wanted to mention was that we did have the expo, the Disability Expo, and it's in the packet, and Barb is here. And I really wanted to thank Barb and the steering committee for the incredible amount of work that they did in putting this thing together. They had all kinds of issues related to the venue having to be changed. Were able to overcome those challenges. And so, Barb, thank you so much for all you've done on that. We really appreciate it, and also your committee. And we'll hear more from Barb later in the meeting on this. That's really all I have, Madam Chairman.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Tracy? Well, we'll move along then. Staff reports. Are there any questions that you'd like to ask Mr. Parsons, having read his report?
He may have something he wants to say.
Do you have something that you'd like to add or say, Tracy?
Just in case.
No. Okay. Well,
I didn't know if I was supposed to add something.
No. Okay. Just an opportunity. Okay. Lynn, is there anything you want to report at this point?
Yes.
Be sure to speak in.
Okay.
Whoops.
We are doing verbal reports instead of written reports because it was a breathtaking pace for the last couple of months. And especially in the 2 weeks leading up to putting the board packet together. So in addition to the expo and the public hearing, which Pete mentioned, we hosted a training in a person-centered planning model. It was at Community Elements. This is mostly in use for ID and DD services. It was very well attended, and some of the people right here were there for the whole 3 days and are now qualified facilitators in that model. I felt really good about that experience for a lot of reasons, which I'll go into some other time. I also wanted to let you know that there's a packet of documents sitting at your seats. It didn't make it into the board packet, but it's a complete set of documents related to the public hearing on the 18th. It's the transcript, the stakeholder comments that we put together as a committee, all of the written testimony that was submitted, and the presentation made by Melissa. I think I've never got it right.
Picciola.
Yeah, from Equip for Equality. I think it's on its own, the packet is very interesting. So we also have a video from that, and I sent the link out, but I wasn't even really sure how to download it. So I don't know, like, you can go to the link and look at it, but as far as keeping it, I haven't figured that out. So maybe we'll get there. Anyway, that's the main stuff.
Thank you, Lynn. Mark?
Well, I guess from what I've been involved in, and, you know, sometimes it's easier just to put it in writing, but a lot of the work has essentially been transitioned from contract year 13 to 14. I've done a lot of site visits and followed up with the reports that I issue in response to the site visits. And I will say that there were no issues identified, in any no significant issues identified with any of the site visits I completed this year. So I'm happy to report that. Also closed out, I guess, 13 in terms of the fourth quarter reports and reviewed the performance outcome reports. That's something I think we'll probably be discussing with agencies in terms of their performance outcome measures for next year, in terms of what we would like to see in their applications. So that's something that will be forthcoming, probably at Mental Health Agencies Council or similar meetings such as that. I've also been involved in some ongoing discussions related to our efforts surrounding the criminal justice and mental health continuum of services. And we've had some, Peter and I have had some meetings with providers on that, as well as with the sheriff's office. And I'm happy to report that the feedback we've gotten from the sheriff's office is that they are very pleased with the work that's ongoing and the level of collaboration that they've experienced with the providers. And we've actually, in response to some of the things that have occurred, done a couple of contract amendments in terms of redirecting the type of services. One, for example, is we're about to issue an amendment related to the substance abuse services that are provided at the to folks as they're exiting the jail, and that they would be providing assessments going forward to some of these folks. There are some requirements associated with the timing of an assessment for accessing substance abuse treatment that requires some significant coordination. But Prairie Center is in. We got a letter requesting this amendment that was signed not only by the executive director of Prairie Center, but also the deputy chief, Alan Jones. So that's an example of the collaboration that we're seeing there. Peter and I have also had a meeting at the sheriff's office, and they again echoed their satisfaction with what's occurring. We're looking at the possibility of setting up a provider meeting to continue to, as Deputy Chief Jones described it, taking it to the next level. So we're continuing to do that work. I also had the opportunity today to participate to attend a meeting of law enforcement officers where they discuss the crisis intervention team activity that they're involved in, as well as just general issues that they have in dealing with people out in the community. Today they had a number of examples surrounding some homeless individuals that they've had contact with. So the meeting that we're looking at holding will extend beyond just working with services at the jail, but also out in the community with law enforcement. So a couple of other things. Ben actually had some very good conversations and reviews related to Parenting with Love and Limits. So that's some positive. And I guess that's about it for in a verbal report this evening. So,
is that all, Mark?
Well, that's, you know, Lynn's had a little, Lynn's life has been a little more hectic than mine with some of the things she's been involved in recently. But I was happy to help where I can. But so.
Yeah. Well, I know you've all been super busy, and it won't stop, will it?
No.
Probably not. We're sure glad we've got you all. Looking at Tracy, too. Okay. Are there any board-to-board reports? Island?
I attended a meeting of the Community Elements Program Quality Review Committee, and there was a wonderful presentation about moral recognition therapy, and we had some discussion about what that was here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to go through this in the interest of saving time, but I thought I'd pass this around. It's a 16-step program, and I just thought I'd pass it around so that you could get an idea of what it's about.
Thank you. Are there any other board-to-board reports?
We can actually make copies of that and make sure everybody gets copies, too.
That would be nice. Why don't we do that?
You can pass it around.
Yeah, because it's not a super long report. It would be nice for everybody to have a copy. Is that okay, Island?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's
okay. Great.
Well, I have a board-to-board report. First, I would like to introduce our new executive director at the Children's Advocacy Center. Adelaide Amy is in the back. Do you want to stand up just briefly? Yeah, thank you. We're very glad to have her. I was going to say we don't miss Mike. That's not a very nice thing to say, and I don't really mean it, but we're awfully glad to have Adelaide. As a member of that board, I want to report to you that in September, the CAC passed its once every 5 years reaccreditation from the National Children's Alliance. The accreditation site visit, which looked at everything from the condition of the facility to the knowledge base of the staff, was a thorough assessment of all aspects of the CAC program. The site visitors stated that they will recommend full reaccreditation and praised both the work of the multidisciplinary team, which investigates the CAC cases, and the CAC staffer, Elaine Mitchell. She is our case manager. They cited her as being the best family advocate either of them had ever met in their hundreds of visits to CACs around the country. And I think that's really noteworthy, and I'd like the minutes to reflect that. Okay. So, moving on then, financial report. Financial information. May I have a motion, please, to accept the claims report that Nancy has prepared for us?
Second.
Did you? Who moved? You moved. Thank you. Thank you, Gertrude. Astrid. And Island seconded it. Any questions or discussion? I forget, do we have to have a vote or a roll call for this money?
No.
Okay. Is that a question? Okay, no. All right. Okay, then all in favor of accepting the finance report, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? It's accepted. Not approved, accepted. Thank you. New business. We're going to start with a presentation on restorative circles by Dr. Elaine Spungen, who is the Director of Psychological Services at the University of Illinois. So I just will turn it over to you, Elaine, and we're looking forward to hearing you. It's right there. It's above you. It's not. Oh, are we kind of in the way?
So what's happened is that the original projector cable didn't work, and the men from TAG were kind enough to just bring an older system, and so the formatting is going to be a little off. It's going to cut off some of the edges.
Okay, you can, if you want, you can sit up there if you're more comfortable.
Can you guys hear me?
Speak in the general direction. It should be good.
Oh, gosh, I'm used to moving around. All right. How's this? Okay. So just bear with me. I invite you to pretend there's bullets on there when there's going to be no bullets because they've all been cut off, the edges. So Mark has been kind enough to also offer. So restorative circles a different way through conflict, and we have a conflict clinic at the Psychological Services Center that I'm also involved with, and this is work that's funded in part by Access Initiative and the Mental Health Board. So what are restorative circles? They're part of restorative justice and restorative practices that are thousands of years old, but also have been updated and modernized for inner city and modern problems. Those of you who know, we have several restorative practices right here in town happening in Darlene's agency and others. But this particular one was developed in Brazil in the 1990s in the inner city, and it was originally mediations between gang, youth gang members, police, and community members. It was funded by the United Nations, a small development grant to do a pilot there, and it's now being done in 23 countries. In Brazil, where it originated, it is now done in entire juvenile court systems and school districts. So this particular model is countrywide. In 2010, this particular model, this restorative circle model, was chosen by Nesta, which is a science think tank, as one of 10 most radically efficient practices in the world, along with mental health aid, which mental health first aid, which many people in this community have taken, and Chicago's CLEAR police initiative with communities. So some statistics are in Brazil where these studies were done. One school district that adopted this decreased their involvement with police by 93%, youth court referrals by 50% in other districts. A smaller evaluation we did this summer in Virginia also looked at a school, very promising results in terms of suspensions, dramatic decreases. However, this practice is still fairly new to the U.S. It's being used in Europe and U.K. and New Zealand more broadly. Thanks. The goals of this particular model, as our general goals of restorative justice, are to restore relationships, repair harm, and to respond to the unmet needs in the system. So rather than thinking of conflict as between two or three people, especially when you're dealing with youth, we start to think about conflict as representing things that aren't working in that system, in that family, in that neighborhood, in that school. So circles, as you'll see in a demonstration, can actually uncover some of those unmet needs in the system and allow us to respond to them. So this is a case illustration. One of the reasons we've chosen to work with this particular model is this incredible fit with the systems of care principles. And I won't go too much into these because I know that both, the folks here and the board has had many presentations around systems of care principles. But we hope that this case can show how the RC model can be youth-guided and driven, empowering and strength-focused, how it can be community-based and owned as well as individualized, restorative, meaning has a healing component, has a way to bridge relationships and repair harm, preventative of future violence, and trauma and justice informed. And those of you who are familiar, if you think about the sanctuary model, what that would mean is that you're thinking about inequities in power. You want shared problem solving, shared conflict resolution. You want people to be able to not celebrate, but have a way to mark losses. You want things to be non-coercive, and you want whatever process you're using to not be re-traumatizing, which, of course, some of the formal justice system processes have sometimes been shown to do in some cases. So this is a case illustration. Most of the identifying information has been changed. So what's interesting here is that, as you'll see at the end, there is a public display about this case somewhere in our community. And the young men who are involved have given us consent to use their names, because if you knew where they lived, you could go to that neighborhood and see their names. However, they're young, and we just decided to change their names and identifying information anyway. So if you know them, you know them, but if you don't, this way, we just felt it would be an extra layer of privacy. So we've changed most of the identifying information, except that they are all African American. So in May of this year, these are four young men at JDC, Jerome, 16, who fatally shot LaVon, 21, last year. Omar and Khalil, 16 and 17, were LaVon's half-brothers, and DeMont, who's LaVon's cousin. They all identify as an African-American, and they all had been at that point through the JDC Restorative Circles program, which is a program where it's 1 hour a week, small group format, teaching about restorative practices, talking about conflict resolution and being more productive and constructive and not so destructive, role-playing, so basic skill building, and letting them know that there's another way to do conflict, tell them about circles. So they've all been through this program. Okay. So it comes to the attention of the staff and also of Jerome that there's talk of a vendetta on his life after he's released from these young men, brothers, cousins, as well as other family, other young people who are cousins and brothers and friends of the deceased. So Jerome requests a circle from our team, and the JDC staff supported this. And so then the conflict clinic team members consulted with Julia Reitz, because at the moment Jerome is still involved in the case, which, as you know, is against the state. That's how it works in America, in the United States. Julia was very supportive of this. She's been supportive of this model all along. We then met individually with each young man for what we call a circle preparation meeting. And during the circle preparation meetings, we want to get clarity on the meaning of the act. The act, in this case, was the fatal shooting for that person. So we're getting their perspective on what happened. We also want to get clarity about how they feel about it and their underlying unmet needs. And I'm not going to demonstrate here, we actually use a card sort to help the youth do this with feeling and needs cards, and they love this card sort. And they often refer to these cards later on in the circle. Like, remember when I turned over envy? I want to talk about that. So it's a very hands-on kind of, and actually, to be honest, more and more the adults that we've been working with are asking for the card sort too. But it's kind of how it began. So the preparation meetings are private and confidential. So I'm not going to tell you exactly what they said, but what I put up on the next slide are typical feelings that are shared in these individual prep meetings with youth we've worked with these kind of intense cases. So it's not necessarily what these young men said, but probably there's a lot of overlap. They talk about being angry, hurt, and sad. They often use the word torn or torn up inside. They talk about fear for safety. Safety comes up, of course, in the case of Jerome, that's obvious, but also about friends and family, because there is an honor code, an honor system in the neighborhoods they come from. They talk about grief. They don't use that language, but they talk about what we would identify as grief as mental health professionals and adults, being confused, not knowing the right thing to do, not wanting to wind up back in jail, not wanting to be a punk, wanting to do the honorable thing as a man in this case, but not wanting to get back in the system. So lots of confusion. I'll also say in the case of Jerome in particular, he had a lot of dreams for himself, has. I shouldn't say it that way. He is the kind of young man who's done a lot of volunteering in our community. I'm just going to make up an arena. He wants to work in a human service arena, and let's say with people with disabilities, has done lots of volunteering, lots of fear that this is going to not allow him to live out his dreams. And shame and embarrassment and all around. I should have done something. I should, you know, that kind of thing. So that's typical. Typical needs that are shared in these kind of meetings with youth. Safety and trust are up. I don't know who I can trust. I don't know if I can be safe. I want fairness, balance. They talk about wanting freedom. I don't want to go back to jail. I want to be free to live my life. Respect and consideration are very important, especially for these young men. And how you navigate relationship with respect and consideration is very complicated because there's codes. Honesty, truth, and unrealness. They talk about wanting to be seen for their intentions, not for, to have the intentions underneath their acts understood and to be understood and heard in general. And I'm not making this up. These meetings are about an hour each, and these things actually get talked about by these youth. Thanks. And you probably can't see that very well, but this is the actual circle meeting overview that took place that same month. So early May, we heard about it, and the circle took place in later in May. It was at the JDC with the staff present. It took place at the JDC because at least one of the young people was there. So even though some of the preparation meetings happened in, they were all in different parts of the process in their adjudication. So we actually had preparation meetings in some of the young men's homes. We had one in the car on the way. We picked somebody up. We got them a sandwich because most of these kids hadn't eaten anything, and did a preparation meeting in the car. But the actual circle happened at JDC, and in those cases, there's always a staff person present. This particular circle was 2 hours long. We always bring snacks. Very, very important during this work. Food all the time. Food at every preparation meeting. Food during the circle. Later on, we'll talk about other things that happened. Food for the staff at the JDC. Breaking bread, very important part of the process. We also have handouts. The process is very transparent. Everything we're going to ask, all our facilitation tools, everybody has them. We're not holding any secrets or cards. So the youth are able to follow all the phases that I'll share in a minute. And, in fact, they're super sharp. At one point, one of them said, I think we're in phase 3. So they were able to track. It's a simple, not easy, but simple process. We like to have two co-facilitators in these circles if we can. In part because we're training clinics, we often invite a less experienced apprentice to sit in with a more experienced person. In this particular circle, because it was such an intense case, we just had the two most experienced people, so I was in there. And we made safety agreements ahead of time, and that's very common. So in the preparation meetings, we want to ask, you know, in our own way, we want to ask, is it going to be okay? Yeah, you're all getting together. Are you going to be okay? And one of the young men said, I don't know. I don't know if I can keep from jumping on him. We said, okay, well, let's talk about what you need to be able to be there. And so we came up with a safety plan that he was going to give us a signal if he felt not okay. He also asked to sit across from the table from the other young man instead of next to. It was just one, it's like one table, rectangular table. And if he gave us a signal, we were supposed to just invite him for a timeout, like invite him for a walk in the hallway. It never happened. I mean, the young man wound up being very engaged, and that's just not the energy that was in the room. But we didn't know that. They didn't know that. So we make these safety plans ahead of time. In Brazil, where this originally got done, like I said, with gang members and police mediations, one of the common safety plans they had is all the guns go in the basket in the door. And then we go in. So we don't have local, we haven't had any circles like that. All the guns go in the basket. Maybe the cell phones have to go in the basket. Mm-hmm. It's probably our biggest. But you do want to have safety agreements ahead of time if you're dealing with this kind of conflict. The circle meeting goes through approximate three phases. In this particular circle, we kind of went through them very cleanly. Other times in my experience, they're kind of, you go back and forth between them. But approximately, you start with mutual comprehension. This is a chance to understand each other's perspectives and to hear each other. Self-responsibility, taking responsibility for your actions and how you were co-responsible for what happened or are going to be co-responsible for what's going to happen. And then at the end, we get to problem solving. At the end, we go to agreed actions. All of these are done through a process called dialogue. And this is the only restorative justice process that I know of that does this particular way. When one person speaks, the other person is asked to reflect back the main thing they're hearing. And they have to keep reflecting it back until the speaker says, you got it. So the speaker decides when they've been heard. And this slows things down enough and assures that people really do hear each other. And since everybody gets to do that, there's a surprising amount of patience usually because you know you're going to get to speak too. So this is how things actually went in the circle. We began with mutual comprehensions. And the first thing that happened, and it was kind of messy, is the other young men had a lot of questions, accusations to the young man who did the shooting. We heard the such and such, and what about, no, you were in that car, and we were told, and what about the time you, and we heard you called and threatened. So it was like, that's how it went. And we just kept, what do you hear him saying? What do you hear him saying? And you just have to track it. That, and then he was explaining back, then so-and-so would explain, wait a minute, that's not what I heard. Wait, did we hear two different things? No, that was the other girl. Which girl? The one at the party. No, there was no party. So this is kind of how it went. So this is that first phase. And after that, which, you know, this went on for not very long, what the young men came to conclusion is that we have caused a lot of trouble and a lot of animosity towards each other through rumors. Because they were able to trace, through us slowing things down and having to reflect, that none of it was true. That the stories didn't mesh, and it was a bunch of rumors, and actually, the things they were thinking about each other, nobody had ever witnessed anything being said or happening that the things they had talked about. So right away, one of the decisions they made verbally is, from now on, if we have a question, we talk directly to each other. I call you up and I say, did you threaten so-and-so? So that was like the first small step in the mutual comprehension. And that usually is the shorter step. Self-responsibility tends to be the longer phase. After they kind of established that, they wanted to know what happened that day. What happened with their brother, what happened with their friend. And when Jerome started describing his story, you could have heard a pin drop in there. They stopped fidgeting, they stopped everything, and they just leaned towards him, and they were just barely breathing, listening to him describe what happened. And the agreement after he told his story and they asked a few questions is that it was an accident. And there was a lot of suspicion ahead of time that it had been an accident, for reasons I'll say later. But because of the rumors and the threats, the guys just didn't know what they could trust. So at this part of the self-responsibility, there was agreement. They're like, okay, man, it was an accident. Thank you. That's really good to know. You didn't shoot my brother on purpose. You didn't shoot my friend on purpose. So then self-responsibility continued, and the issue of fairness and balance came up. Hey, it was an accident. That's unfortunate. But in the street, the code is a life for a life. We're sorry. Like, that's how it works. You know, it doesn't change anything. I mean, it changes some things. We feel better, but it doesn't change how things work around here. That was one of the things that was being said. So it can be very intense in there. One of the young men said, and they started talking about, what are serious enough consequences? Is life in prison serious enough for my brother to be gone forever? At one point, Jerome said, here's a serious consequence. I'm never going to see my best friend again. So So it turned out in the process of this that these two young men, the one who did the shooting and the one who died, were actually best friends. And everybody there agreed. Said, I'm never going to get to see my best friend again. And the other young man said, well, I'm never going to get to see my brother again. So there was kind of this almost stuckness. And then, even as things start to soften, the other young man said, you know what, even if we decide to leave you alone, we can't stop the other people in the neighborhood. Everybody in the school is talking. The entire neighborhood is talking. This young man was very popular. We can't stop them from doing revenge. So just there was that moment of kind of stuckness and in the revenge paradigm. And this is where I feel like this model can be so powerful, because we're just facilitating their process. We're not going to step in, hi, we heard that there's this other, right? We're not going to do that. This is a youth-driven process. So you set the model in motion. People hear each other. They identify their unmet needs, and then you give them space. And in that space, as they sat there in that stuckness, and they looked at each other and listened to each other, there was a shift. And the turning point was DeMond. And he said, well, you know, we are all friends, or we used to be, and actually some of us are family. And they started talking about ways in which they were interconnected. My mama and your cousin didn't. They go to so-and-so's baptism that one time. Yeah, I think your aunt so-and-so and my aunt so-and-so go to church together. Totally, we totally didn't do anything there. They started making these connections. And then Khalil said, you know, there is more to life than revenge. They started talking about their future. Started talking about fatherhood. Some of them already had babies. Some of them wanted to have babies. One of them, I don't want to say who, thought they were in love with somebody who they wanted to marry and have babies with. So they started talking about the future and what kind of future we're going to have if we just take this to the street. Where are we going to wind up then? And then Khalil said, you know, this is not what Levon would want. He said, if he were here, he'd say, you guys are stupid. Why are you even talking about this? You should be out doing something more constructive. And then finally, Omar said, I want to tell you a story about the other F word. And this is a story his mother apparently told him. He hadn't remembered this story until now. But the other F word, at the end of this fairly long story, wound up being forgiveness. And they all had a little kind of laugh about it. So that's where things shifted to. And after that, that's where Lamont said, I think I'm tracking that we're in the last phase, problem solving. Because they felt in the room that they had understood where they wanted to go next. And so this is the agreed actions that they came up with unbelievably together. And I am often amazed at this part of the circle, because the agreed actions are often so creative and so unbelievable that it's young people or whoever it might be coming up with them. So one of the actions they come up with is if they see each other in the street, they can be polite and keep it moving. They're going to go like this, not talk to each other, not be friendly, but no attacks. They also decided to co-create together, all of them, a memorial poster and a video in Lamont's memory. And they asked for our help with this. And that's how we got to see them again, because we wound up working on this poster together. And that's when they gave their consent for this presentation. The video wound up not happening, or hasn't happened yet, because you're not allowed to videotape at the JDC, which we didn't know. So, I thought I was going to just bring in my iPad, and they were going to do poetry. They were going to read their own poetry in his honor, but that didn't happen. So it may still happen in the future. Omar was supposed to post on Facebook that the vendetta was squashed. There is a Facebook page in this other young man's memory, which we've seen. So this was going to be a way to let people know. And Khalil was going to verbally talk to others in the school and neighborhood and say, hey, we're the brothers, we're the cousins. We say, you know, let them be. It's squashed. And the other agreed action is Jerome kind of quietly turned to one of us and said, can we help him get in touch with Levon's family? So it turned out that since it happened, the two families had not been able to speak because there was this assumption of hostility and because he was now in a judicial process against the state. So I'm not going to talk too much about that. We were able to do that because I was only able to get in touch with two out of the three families that wound up getting involved for full consent. Just to say that, I'll say that we were able to. So those are the actions that they agreed on around this issue. And this is the actions in motion. We call that involving the village. We were able to make family connection between LaVon's and Jerome's family. And I'll just say that multiple adults were involved and that it was incredibly touching. That tears were shed and apologies were made and tokens of LaVon's life were exchanged. And it meant a lot to LaVon's family, who had never heard from Jerome or his family, just because of how our court system works sometimes. So that was amazing. Took a lot of legwork, I'll just say, to find and get them together in a neutral space that was safe. They did wind up making a memorial poster together. We helped them really mostly with emotional support and the art supplies. I bought the art supplies. And then they decided to post it publicly in the community, which kind of happened spontaneously while they were making it. And it turned out that there's a business person in the community where they live who all the kids trust and like. And that business person, so somebody from our team, one of the grown-ups, went and said, is it okay to display this in your glass case publicly, like from the inside the way you would display, you know, a poster of milk prices. And he said that would be great. So that's where it is right now. And what they wind up doing, I'll show you a photograph, is they left some blank spaces on this poster for other kids to sign. So other kids have been coming by and also adding things to LaVon's memory. And it's publicly displayed. And all their names are displayed. They put their first and last names in. They're very proud of themselves. I mean, I'm always like, confidentiality. But they're like, this is an amazing thing we've done. Conflict Clinic members have been involved. So this business owner has been involved. The family has. Families wind up being involved. We've had multiple meetings, fed them many, many times. And we also wind up going to the court hearing just for Jerome. And then the other interesting thing that happened is that, again, without giving out too much, I'm sorry, I made up these names. But DeMont and LaVon's families wind up having a different circle, wind up asking for a circle around DeMont's placement. So basically, one of the kids wound up not having a home to come home to, and LaVon's family got involved there. So it wasn't a circle like a conflict, but a circle of the kind of get together and discuss what can be done for this young man. So that was also very interesting, another way to kind of bring in the village. So that you can't, I don't know if you can see that. If it'll help to turn off the light, I don't know. Is that worth it? Notes that they wrote to him that they pasted all around, letters actually. And I have a little excerpt from Jerome's letter, and it's much longer than this. And he says in part, "You were my," it's a poem, "you were my right-hand man, my brother, my best friend. I still can't understand. I had to let my tears burst. I felt I was cursed. Now you're gone, and a huge part of me is also gone. I understand where I went wrong. I think I'm going crazy. I'm feeling so insane. It's been a year and it still hurts. Why couldn't it have been me? But I'm resting in peace because I know that we'll all meet again. We're all God's children." And there were several letters like that to the young man who died. So wanted to thank a lot of different organizations and people who helped this one case come together, the Access Initiative, Mental Health Board, the Psychology Department for funding and support, JDC staff and administration, which have been amazing and put in a lot of time, effort, and support into this, except for the preparation meetings. They have to be there for every time that we're in contact with the kids, a lot of extra effort on their part. I want to thank our youth for their courage and vulnerability and strength to approach conflict differently. I think this takes a lot of courage to do it this way. Families and community members for support and willingness to show up and try something different. And Dominic Barter, the creator of Circles, Conflict Clinic members, fellow community organizations and members for encouraging and supporting this work for many years now. And I just put up the names of the Conflict Clinic members in the next slide. And some of these are paid through the through this grant. So thank you. And hopefully that displayed some of the ways that those principles worked in action.
I think at this point, Lane, you're open to questions and
yes.
discussion.
If anybody has any.
I have a question. It seems like this is a very intense kind of thing. And I was curious at the time span that it took from the beginning to this kind of resolution. And I suppose then inevitably, how many of these things can you handle at the same time?
Yes. I think like other, you know, family-centered, youth-driven interventions like wraparound, it can be time-intensive. Mm-hmm. So this case maybe took a little bit longer because the youth asked us to be involved in some of the actions. And that's a little bit unusual, although it was wonderful. Otherwise, the case got brought to our attention early May, and we had to circle by the end of May. So in some ways, another way of saying that is the preparation meetings are about an hour each. They can be 30 minutes. With a case like this, where there's a fatal shooting, we'll take a little bit longer. With something a little smaller, we'll take 30 minutes. And then the circles themselves have been taking about 2 hours, pretty typically with snacks and kind of maybe a tiny break in between 2 hours and 15 minutes. Sometimes we have an evaluation meeting afterwards, a half an hour, just to see how things are going. In this case, we instead kind of got involved with the youth. So I think it can be time intensive. Organizations and schools that when they adopt these kind of this model whole scale. Because of the intensity, one of the things they do, they train everybody to be facilitators. Custodial staff, the women who work in, you know, people who work in the cafeteria, the bus drivers, the students themselves, and teachers, of course, and administrators. So that you have a whole community of interested facilitators. And it's not a really a professional model, you know, when it's implemented in a whole setting.
Thank you.
Is that helpful? Yeah.
Who initiated this circle?
Jerome.
He came to you?
So we're in the, yeah, we're in the JDC on Fridays to do the other programming.
As a circle team.
Right, but that programming is sort of conflict resolution role plays, talking about constructive conflict. So on, and then there's this opportunity to kind of talk to us privately afterwards. So he came to us and asked, you know, can we do one of those things that we do on Fridays, but, you know, for real and bigger? And then we went to the staff. So we have had circles at the JDC before this one. This is the most intense case in terms of, you know, what the act was. A lot of times the circles are around family interactions, like the one I talked about before is a little more typical. Where is this kid going to go? Or, you know, I'm sick and tired of your drinking. So, yeah, that's why we went to Julia as well. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons to me it's initiated by the youth. It's a very owned process. Mm-hmm.
Elaine?
Yeah.
It would be wonderful if such a process could be embedded in a community. Now, have you guys thought about how that might be done or whether it could be done?
I think that would be wonderful. That would be another restorative process that we have in our community. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking to organizations and to youth services and, you know, even with RPC about what would be appropriate cases to refer to a circle, this kind of process, you know, as opposed to mediation or peer court, because you want to think about where the fit is. So I think as as we, you know, connect with agencies and services in town, and as it becomes more clear what kind of cases are appropriate, I think it is part of the community. It will be part of the community. Another way that it's sometimes adopted is by an entire school unit or an entire school district. So that's a different way. I think that's not the direction we're quite going right now versus, like, at the JDC, or if some of the youth in the assessment center were referred, they wouldn't all be part of the same school, but they may know each other.
Yeah.
No, well, yeah, no, that's a great question. So some of the people there were students at the university, and so they're taking this for credit. They're learning that way. A couple of them were graduate students, and you're helping fund. They're the ones who are most intensely involved and spending the most hours, and you guys, Access Initiative, is helping fund part of that time. And then the two people with the PhDs, myself and Dr. Lubansky, that it's part of our research, it's part of our work. I play a fairly small part in the conflict clinic, in the training and in some of these more intense cases. And when I do, the department covers that, the psychology department. So restorative practices are currently considered a cutting-edge practice. There's actually some interesting research that's shown that they reduce trauma symptoms in what's considered victims. I think this case is really interesting because we didn't do this measurement, but I think the person who was usually thought of as the offender also experienced trauma. So restorative practices can really, you know, be both a community building as well as a mental health intervention. So the psychology department is very supportive of it.
So I guess this one individual, young man, came to you and said, please do this for us. But do you do interventions where someone said, hey, we really need your help, and there's these people who need to talk to them?
Like, do you mean someone referring a young person, like pushing them, kind of saying, I think this...
They think that this program, this process would work for them, but, you know, they don't know anything about it.
Right.
I mean, how do you get the exposure to...
Yeah.
I mean, if you pick up the Chicago Tribune, you see there's how many killings every day.
Right.
That's the headline on the front page of the Tribune for the last several months. And how do you get to the street?
So part of your question is sort of how do you get the word out that this is available? So in this case, the JDC, right, so there's we have two groups, 10 kids each every week, and they're all exposed to it. So some of those are there just for one time because luckily they're out the next week. Others have been with us for many months and a couple for more than a year. So those referrals are coming from the kids themselves and the JDC staff. I think the next steps for us, and also we have to be careful of building our own capacity, is to connect to other youth-serving organizations. So we've met with different youth-serving organizations in town and to connect to their staff and to say, this process is available, this is what it looks like, it's intense. If you see a family, if you see a youth that may benefit, then they can refer them. But built into the process is non-coerciveness. We call it voluntariness. So when we meet with folks, we always make it really clear that you have lots of options in town, family therapy, PLL, your minister, you know, and here's what this model is like, and are you interested or not? It's totally, like, okay if you're not.
Yeah, one last question.
Yeah. So our next step is actually doing more formal evaluations. So we're in the process right now of you know, collecting instruments that have been used by other restorative justice initiatives and officially doing an evaluation. In this case, what we do is something called a post-circle usually. It's an informal meeting to evaluate how things are going. That hasn't happened in part because the youth is still moving through the system. So in this case, we're kind of working with them while they're still moving through the official system. But research is the next step. Yes?
But I do understand that
in Brazil, significant amounts of research has been done in this process. All over the world, significant amounts of research have been done in similar process. The closest process in North America, you might be familiar with, are family group conferences. This particular process is fairly new in the United States. This model, which to us is very, very aligned with, you know, the systems of care principles. So other practices like it have shown tremendous, you know, reductions in recidivism, suspensions, police contact, trauma symptoms in one large study for victims only, and other really promising things. This particular model, we would be kind of on the cutting edge of researching, if that makes sense.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's really amazing and wonderful. Well, on to other business, I guess. I know. You have before you the draft of a draft three-year plan from this year to 2015 with 2014 objectives. Do you want to ask any questions about it or comment about any part of it? Yes, Peter.
I was just going to say that this has been sent out to providers and stakeholders and, you know, for comment. And that we, of course, want comments from the board if there are any. I think for the most part, the plan at this point is, we'll take the comments and bring this back to you next month for final approval.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
That's our usual process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Anything you want to ask or discuss at the moment? And then we'll just move along then to the next item, which is the allocation criteria for 2015. It's in your packet. I hope you've had a chance to look at it pretty closely. If you have comments, they are welcome. any comments from any board members? Oh, Peter.
Oh, Tom has.
Tom. Either
oh.
one.
Well.
Go ahead, Peter.
This will be the same thing. This is a draft. We're asking for comments from, again, the same folks. I think the thing I want to point out is in the introduction, the first several paragraphs, this is a year that there's going to be incredible amounts of change occurring. We're talking about all of the different things that are happening in this state with the Medicaid expansion and Affordable Care Act, and a variety of things are happening, and we really don't know exactly how everything is going to play out. So, we've identified the areas that I think we will want to focus on based on what we're doing this year. We don't anticipate a whole lot more money. Interestingly, we think that we're going to get more money than what we anticipated when we did the budget. Unfortunately, on the DD board side, they're getting less than what we anticipated. So we have that kind of perverse thing going with the levy and the fact that we're not at the top of the levy. So anyway, at this point, I think that, there's a lot of stuff going on. We've identified access initiative sustainability as one of our major areas. A continuation of our commitment to youth is another priority, and we identify PLL and quarter cent. Those things are the areas there. We're also talking about the behavioral health services and supports for adults in the criminal justice system as an area that we've begun working on this year and that we want to continue working on. Priority number five, I think we probably should explain that just a little bit. There have been some other local funders that have talked about issues related to psychiatric services, as well as the possibility of a emergency shelter for families. And those are areas that we might collaborate with other funders on, similar to what we did with 211, and I would anticipate we would have some sort of a interagency agreement or a memorandum of understanding. But the idea here is that we wanted to let you know that those things are sort of, they may not come, but we thought that they're important for us to consider them. And anyway, that's, I don't know, Mark, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Astrid.
I haven't really done with it. Why is intellectual disabilities added to developmental disabilities?
That's kind of language that's going on nationally. Developmental disabilities encompasses an array of problems, which can include things like cerebral palsy and things like that, and not necessarily intellectual, intellectual disability. This also kind of comes into play with the elimination of the R word in the lexicon, that being retardation. So instead of that, I think it more accurately is described that you have people that have intellectual disabilities. And so nationally, if you look at what's happening in the field and with the variety of things that are going on, instead of just saying developmental disabilities, they're now saying intellectual disabilities and developmental disabilities. So,
Tom, you had something.
We have not done an application workshop in the past. We're certainly available to provide technical assistance and, respond to questions. That was something that's actually been brought up, I think, last spring at our Mental Health Agencies Council. We do have extensive instructions that are available. We're very open to providing any technical assistance that somebody's interested or that somebody asks for.
What we're requiring this year, is it distinctively different than what we've required in the past? Or pretty much follows the same?
I'd say that with the exception of probably priority five, most everything in some fashion has appeared in the past.
Okay.
We're with priority four related to behavioral health and criminal justice. We've probably expanded the language that we've included there reflect a greater interest in services through for folks involved with the jail.
So a workshop may not be necessary.
We'll probably talk about that.
One thing that you might want to try, and we did this when we first put the online system on, and that was go on it, make up an agency, and go through the process. It's relatively user-friendly, I think. I'm sure there are several of those bogus applications around at this point. I would have felt, no, we didn't approve any of those. But I think that it's relatively easy to use, and we do. I think that we have done that in the past.
Sure.
In fact, when Bill Collin was here, he made up his own foundation,
yes.
Did a kind of a sample application that was pretty funny.
Oh, I bet it was.
And we have, Lynn and I have met with our systems person, our consultant. And he's going to be coming back in the next few weeks to talk about some enhancements that we've spoken to him about regarding the system. We do have a particular form that is proves, it's the personnel form that proves to be a bit of difficult at times, especially if you're a first-time applicant. So, or a new staff person to an agency that we have an existing relationship, and that person has to come in and deal with that particular form. So,
on the next page, under the secondary decision support and priority criteria, right under that it says approach, methods, and innovations. And it reads, applicants proposing evidence-based or research-based approaches, and in addition, address fidelity to the specific model cited. Applications demonstrating creative and or innovative approaches to me. Are those in conflict with each other, or are you saying you'll do both? We want people to do the evidence-based project, and then we also want innovative and creative applications that may not be evidence-based. Yeah, is that what we're saying?
Yes, that is correct. We're looking for both.
We're going to do both. Okay.
These are, I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago we had a whole bunch of secondary criteria, and we sort of got rid of it because we didn't find it
sure.
to be very helpful. But we did think that, the evidence-based and, trauma-informed
sure.
and all those
right.
kinds of things, and as well as, I think restorative circles is a creative, innovative
right.
Approach. You know,
right.
Not evidence-based as your questions
sure.
Found, but it certainly is creative.
And then I have one other comment there. Is that, in reading these last two, I notice there's a lot of acronyms in those pages, and there are quotes around them. I wonder if we could just create a glossary that goes in every. It's a permanent glossary, and it just goes. It just automatically goes into the packet, and every time a new set of acronyms comes up, it can be added. We would just always have it available. And there.
We have a glossary. I think we should use it more and add to it. It's a good suggestion.
We do have a glossary. About the only time you see it, though, is on an annual basis when we release the program summaries. We could put that up on our website so that agencies are familiar with it, but most of the things that we're defining are things that they're using and that you as board members may not be familiar with. So the glossary that we've had in the past is more intended for your use than as opposed
yeah,
to
well, that's what I was thinking for me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That it would go in this package, and every time it would always be in the back, and I could –
Yep.
We actually do make an effort, like in this memo, I think every acronym is explained
right.
somewhere. But
but it'd be nice to just have a list of all these acronyms that you could refer
that,
to,
we?
Right?
Do we have a list of acronyms?
Yes, we do, but the only time we actually give it to you is in April.
Well,
so
maybe we need to haul it out.
So I guess I suppose we could just – make a better effort to be sure that the acronyms that we are using are defined prior to using.
I just hate to think that we'd have to do that every time we saw something, make a list of acronyms. It would seem like if we had one and
mm-hmm.
paste
yeah.
it on our forehead or something like that.
I think it'd be helpful to have it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Like
mm-hmm.
soon, like
sure,
November.
I mean, we can dust it off.
Would you do that, Mark?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Or somebody?
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay, great.
And one of the things we do as we go through the program summaries is if there's something that's new in there, we add it to the list and define it.
Well, I've had trouble looking up some in the past.
Yeah. Well,
I tried to look them up, and they're not there.
Yeah. Well, those are the ones I want to hear about so that we can get those in.
Good. Okay. Tom, anything else?
No.
Very, very helpful. Thank you. Any other comments, sir? Mike, you usually have.
I have one question.
Yes, Julian.
It's a little bit hard for me to frame the question because I know
in part this gets done, but it's sometimes it's having been through this now once, I'm still left with a feeling that I don't quite grasp, which is, do we have a mechanism that enables us to seriously evaluate?
That's a change.
I don't mean doing research like university research when I say that. I mean just evaluate what value we're getting from the many programs that we support, or many agencies that we support over a long period of time. Part of me has a feeling that sometimes it becomes almost, I know this is not intended at all, so it's hard for me to quite say it in a way that doesn't sound, I don't want to get the wrong spirit of this out there, but I have a little bit of a concern that there's a kind of built-in, well, we've always been supporting that, and so then we get another application, and it sort of feels like, well, kind of awkward to, how do we have some way that we can actually look at these things and with enough time to do it seriously? So what I'm wondering out loud to myself is if we don't need some kind of a sort of, not just at the period at which these things are now applying again, but if we don't need some sort of, throughout the course of the year, some sort of rolling look at, rolling assessment of the various things that we support, where we can have actually some conversation with ourselves, or maybe with the, and maybe include the people themselves, so that we have a more up-to-date sense of what value is coming from these things, and as opposed to it's just, I'd like to eliminate the feeling that it's just, well, it's been supported before, so it'll be supported in the future. If I'm making myself clear, I hope. A little hard to express it without making it sound like I think people aren't doing great things, and many people are, but just sort of to assure ourselves of what is and what isn't.
And we don't always know for sure what is being done. Right? I mean, we used to.
So I'm wondering if there's not some way we could begin to create a sort of rolling look at the things that we're supporting. I guess maybe that's the end of my question.
Well,
and I don't expect an answer right now. I just wanted to raise it into the. It just seemed like the right time to have that enter our deliberation.
I think it's a good thing to raise, and that we might really consider this. We went through some years of asking agencies to come and report to us, you know, a few at a time or one or two at a time. And I think I'm one of the ones who said to Peter, I'm not sure this is as helpful as we'd really like it to be, because the data wasn't useful. I mean, it was, and they were, frankly, some of them boring, because it was just data instead of discussion of issues and so on. So I think it might be a good thing to go back to something like that, but with a different emphasis. You know, a different form. I want different information.
So maybe we could, as a board, think about what kind of information would we want?
Yeah.
How might we accomplish something that would make us all feel collectively more confident that we actually know what it is that we're supporting?
I kind of feel that.
Sometimes these kinds of issues are thrashed out in a retreat format, in other words, where you have over a period of time you can work through some of these things. I think it's very difficult. It's easier to agree with your in principle than it is to figure out how the hell are we going to do that, what measures do we want, what format do we want to use.
That's why I expressed it so gingerly rather than forcefully.
Yeah, and I'd hate to just to dump that on the staff at this point, given all their responsibilities. So I think that's a board responsibility to identify these issues, what we want. And I would suggest some kind of a retreat format where it can be worked through.
Thank you.
You know, whenever you're going to deal with this kind of reporting, follow-up, it's going to be boring. Because you are going to look at the numbers. And at least I would. Whenever, we're using other people's money.
money to fund these programs. I don't think it's a staff problem, it's not a board problem, it's an agency problem. What they have to show us, if we ask them, come on in here and just show us about this program. We gave you this much money. How was it used? What did it cost per person? It's their job to show us that they're using the proper skills and going along with what their application said to justify getting that money. If they're not doing it, why would we fund them again? We wouldn't. You know, I think, you know, having been on this board for a while now, I know there's a lot of duplication, I believe, in where we're funding little bitty amounts of this for the same thing, but it goes to different agencies, which I think maybe we need to work on. And I don't think all of our money really goes to the spot it's really supposed to go. Don't know that, don't need hard facts, but I think it's up to us if we're going to question whether we keep funding and funding and funding the same program. We should know. And I don't think we have to, you know, examine everyone, but we do a spot check. We do so many per year, and we just have those agencies come in and say, okay, here it is, and then we ask them some questions. Mm-hmm. That's what I do.
That's good.
Oh, yes, Astrid.
I think so many of the reports come in as numbers. As how much we spend on Earth and how many people we move through. And what we really want to know is, have we made the changes that we are supposed to be making with that money, rather than just the number things which don't tell you anything except how they're marketing.
This is for marketing. Don't you guys do site visits?
Yeah, that's good.
I just finished reading an article. So we do site visits each year at least. And
so
also,
everybody.
Yes. Every funded program is it's a site visit or a record review depending on the type of contract. So those are completed at least once a year. We also require quarterly reports from every agency for every funded program, and we review the quarterly reports, and we ask for at least, I would ask for lots of corrections. There's information that doesn't match up or is missing, and we just now finished looking at the annual performance outcomes reports for every funded program, and I did a summary of the DDRs. It's not a very helpful summary. Provide any insight, and that led me to start asking for help from people outside of this community. I mean, if we're asking, if our requirements for data collection and reporting are maybe too much for the agencies, I mean, I kind of want to know what is the impact of the data collection that we're causing them to engage in, and what we could do differently. And I just contributed an article about it just like an hour or two ago. It is, you know, it's the spirit of this conversation matches up completely with that. We should be really identify what's important, not just the kind of data that we've been taking for years and years, but what we want, what's important. Just looking at that, and it's not a very deep article. I shared with you earlier. But it's nice because it's the same sentiment as being shared right now.
Well, that seems to be much of the contain some of the information that we're looking for, would it not? The evaluation, I mean, it seems to me you would have some clue by the time you do your visits, et cetera, the answer to some of those questions, what's going on, what's positive.
But the challenge is for you to define what's important.
But it doesn't, what I'm trying to figure out is there some way that we can get the information without creating a labor-intensive process and focusing on what we got and maybe becoming a little more familiar with that. And then from that, we could begin to develop a framework. Now, like, is this sufficient information, or do we need something else, and what is that?
Mike?
For Julian and Bill, and then I go on down the line, I guess it's for everybody, because I fear that I am now maybe the most long-tenured member of the board.
But when I joined the board, and I can't tell you when that was because it's lost in the mists of time, I had the same sort of questions. And when I joined the board, there were still a lot of heat and discussions about whether we should have or not have funded the CAC. So the decision had been made, but Katie Foster particularly would just kind of bring this up sometimes to remind us of how we're supposed to make these decisions. Katie was the representative from the North County, and she was something of a hawk on these issues, and I encouraged her and maybe egged her. But we did have discussions about this, and for Tom, I remember when I said, what do all these things mean? And we probably should have laminated them instead of reproducing them every month. But yes, I can't keep up. I'm still trying to figure out the ones from the Navy 40 years ago. I don't think NAVSUX was actually an acronym, but it was one I heard a lot. But there have been changes. There have been consolidations. There have been agencies that simply dropped from the rolls for whatever reason. So there is an ongoing process. It's kind of like watching paint dry, I suppose. It's not real exciting, but we do try to keep an eye on these things. But, like I said, I don't think many of you have not really observed this process. When we have them come in, and we've had some marvelous presentations, some exactly like what Julian and Bill were talking about, but when you sit and think about how much time and effort they took out of their jobs to create this presentation, that is a little bit troubling. And then, of course, the amount of attention we pay and the follow-up. Tom and I had this experience also in the school board setting. We went over things, and they would say, well, go back and pull off that report that was done in the 78. And so a lot of it, they feel, and sometimes we can get to feel, like it's just an exercise. Nobody's going to follow up on it. They're not really going to do anything. Well, we have seen changes. There were things that happened with the school board that led to changes. But sometimes you kind of wish there would be more follow-up. But and this is another great debate with our good old ex-friend Rich Zollinger. Quantification. There is an element, a substantial element in education, and I would say here, that says, I want you to show me, measure it, show me a number. And then there's people like me who figure, you just can't do that. You need to do something, but you can't take behavioral or educational processes and quantify them that way. If you do, you get something like, oh, no child left behind. And we do get, within the bodies of the reports that we have now, we do have them talk about client satisfaction and this sort of thing. So, things that we want to know, but you don't know sometimes if you're just getting the same thing over and over and over again. So I don't have a solution for it. I think it lies somewhere outside of trying to use calipers, but it is something that we have been conscious of and working on, and it's not to say that there couldn't be a new approach or a better effort.
I was just going to mention that all of the applications, there are performance measures, and staff have been discussing the need to sort of beef that up. And if anything, I think we want to have a conversation with providers and applicants to talk about that and to, you know, really focus more on, our, you know, what happens to clients? Are they actually getting better? You know, is there, and, but I, you know, there has been, I think Michael is right that there has been some change when you think about PLL, you know, has a really good evaluation component. Everything Access Initiative is doing has evaluation tied to it. Some of the stuff with specialty courts, we know exactly who graduate. You know, there's criteria for getting through the program, and you know who, how many people get through it, and how many don't. In the 3-year plan, there's a statement in there about looking at a billing system. And what that is about is actually Mark is going to be going up. One of our sister 708 boards has a billing system that works for Medicaid. It's actually approved by HFS, the Healthcare and Family Services, but it also can be used for non-Medicaid. And I think we've mentioned in, you know, in this document that we really want to move toward more of a person-centered plan, more of a process where our money follows people as opposed to funding specific programs. And the idea here is that we think we can get a handle on that with this particular billing system, which actually mirrors what the agencies do that bill to the state. And so to really focus more on individuals, be able to, when we do site visits, pull a bill and go in and look at actually what happened on that day of service, tie it back to the service plan, and then be able to give you information like that. So those are some of the ideas that we have at this point, and, obviously we're open to suggestions.
Yeah, I really just want to have us thinking about these things. That's, I don't have a plan, although my thought in general is that, I mean, some things that we fund, we're it. If we didn't fund it, it wouldn't exist. In some ways, that's an easy thing to look at. Is this something we want to exist? Or do we think we could use the money better for other things? Some things that we fund, I think, kind of go into... I understand that agencies need to ask for things specifically, but it's not always clear to me. But that may be just because I haven't had enough reading of it. That what we're doing is when we're providing funds that we're actually getting value added to what they would do if we didn't do it. What are we getting, what are we adding to, I think that's part of what we should be doing is seeing what comes because we're supporting particular efforts. So, again, I don't really have a very concrete way that I have in mind to get at this. I just think these are the kinds of questions that I actually think the staff should force the board to ask these questions. Not because we want you to do more work. You guys do more work than I can conceive of. And really, we're just a volunteer board. We're not full-time employees. We're not going to have the time to do our own comprehensive evaluations. But I think we do have a kind of policy obligation to say, okay, is this a genuine contribution to our community? Not just going through a kind of the motions because they filled out a form correctly, but because we actually believe there's some value added to our community from the specific thing that we're giving money for. That's sort of my general point of view, and I'm anxious to hear more about what Peter was talking about. Not right now, but
well, I was going to ask you how you think we should proceed. But you've already said, I think, let the staff do it.
Well, I'd like to get, I'm sorry, excuse me. I would like to get that article. Maybe you could just circulate the article for one thing to
good.
Help us.
Let's start
be
with
informed.
That.
I mean, copy it for everybody. Or send it on email.
20 copies by accident.
Oh.
So I
could
just go get them.
Good.
This is specific to these services, but I think the principles are.
I mean, it's just some
maybe there's a model.
Stephanie does the site
with the
refugees too. And also, she does other contact monitoring that I don't even know.
Tom.
So, her
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Do you want me to go get this?
Yes.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Isn't that funny that I accidentally made enough copies?
There's something going on here. Tom.
I think this conversation is actually pretty timely. I happen to wander into the budget review for the county board that Peter had to perform at about 2 months ago. And one of the major, I think things went well, mostly. But one of the questions that he was faced with is, do any of these programs work? And not work in the sense of do people come and go, but do we have a full-blown evaluation with randomized controls and experimental groups and
that's
stuff
good.
Like that. And so I don't expect that is going to happen. Certainly it's not going to happen for all the programs. I know with Ernie's suggestion of us sitting down and doing a retreat to come up with some, maybe there could be a random selection of some programs that we would evaluate more intensely than others. But I think it would help Peter the next time he has to appear before the board to be able to say, yes, we're in discussions about this, and we recognize that we need to do more evaluations than we currently do. And I guess I can encourage you, Ann. We're not going to do these real extensive things that you see, but some way of being able to ask the question is, are they better than what they were when they came here?
So. My concern at the moment is that unless we kind of have a plan for moving forward with these thoughts and ideas, they could fall between the cracks. And I think it's important that we continue this discussion, but it's a whole month till another meeting, and I don't know what to do about that. Yes, Astrid.
What was asked for at the board meeting was highly inappropriate. Research stuff with controls and double-blind studies and so on. It was 708 for it. This is not some sort of remote think tank. And you could not, it would be highly inappropriate to do any of the things that he was asked to do at the board meeting. So this is entirely separate.
Let me be clear, that's not what I was asking for.
No, it's not at all what he's asking for.
Well, he's asking at the board.
Okay. Mark, you have a suggestion for...
Well, I just would like to, I guess, share some things. In the application, as Peter mentioned, each program is asked to identify measures associated to access, consumer outcomes, and then utilization. Utilization is how many people have you served. Access is how are you deciding who gets served. And the consumer outcomes is are they better off today than they were yesterday as a result of the intervention. Each agency has flexibility in terms of how they propose to measure that. Some agencies, some of the larger agencies, and it's I'll use Prairie Center and Community Elements, actually use an evaluation. Clients' rights is what comes to mind, which is what Community Elements use. But it's a survey. A client completes a survey, and then those results and those basic questions are there. They complete the survey, and then that is aggregated and compared against, at a national level, organizations of a similar nature and similar size. And they report those outcomes in relation to the measures that they've established in their application. Other agencies use similar tools. Crisis Nursery has an evaluation tool that is used. So there are measures that are identified by each individual agency in their applications, and they do report those results back to us. And those results are summarized in their applications and then are referenced in the program summaries. So there is there is a feedback loop that exists. Now, whether or not those measures are adequate, that is another question, and it varies by agency. Some agencies are very specific in terms of what they're going to measure and in reporting back the results. Other agencies, not so much. But it varies by sophistication of the organization in which those funds are being invested. And the other thing that I think needs to be kept in mind is the breadth of services that we fund. Where our dollars are invested in services to serve people with a developmental disability, people suffering from an addiction, people suffering from a mental illness. And so you can't necessarily evaluate across those services because they're different. And then you also have services that are targeted to children, to youth, to adults, to seniors. We also have, in terms of parenting with love and limits, yes, we have a very strong evaluation associated with that, but there's a price that comes with that. You know, there's additional money that's paid out to get that evaluation for that supervision to assure that fidelity to the model. I think this is a wonderful discussion, and I appreciate it, but we try to work with the agencies. We ask them to do things. Peter and I have had conversations. Lynn, as she mentioned just today, about the research that she's done. Mm-hmm. We do look at these questions. And I appreciate the interest of the board in the subject. And I would like to see better measures. I'm just not sure how to get there. So.
Right. Thank you, Mark. You've mm-hmm. made some very important points. Yeah. I appreciate that. We do. Nevertheless, I sense that among board members there's an interest in at least talking about these issues further. Right. Yeah, and I'm going to try to wrap up the meeting because it's the hour is getting late. But, if Juliana, you can say what you want to say.
Oh, well, all I was going to say now is just that I don't want what I was saying to be overread. The kinds of issues that occurred to me, just listening, and I already know what you said, and I appreciate it, actually. I think it's a pretty good job that you guys do. I hope there's no implied criticism the staff. I mean, I think it's great.
Well, not at all.
I mean, the kind of question that occurs to me sometimes is, does anybody ever report, we really didn't do what we were hoping to do.
Now and again, they do, don't they?
So I would take that seriously. And here's how we're going to change it in order to do better.
Yeah.
That kind of feedback would be nice to know. And the other thing is, it is possible to do something like goal attainment scaling, which is not that complicated, really, and it allows every agency to set their own goals, and yet you have sort of a bench standard for how far you've gotten toward those goals. And those could be compared across agencies who are dealing with completely different problems and completely different people. And so, just if we know that they said, if you give us this money, this is what we'll do, and they can report something that seems factual about how much of that they accomplished, that would be great. And it's not necessarily the case that, to me at least, it's not necessarily the case that if an agency, especially if they're trying out something new, they say, well, it didn't work as well as we hoped, so here's the 6 changes we're going to make this year to make it work better. I think that would be great information that I think would be way better than random experiments.
Okay, well, let's just promise ourselves that we are not going to leave this topic.
Yeah.
We will continue to think and talk about it. And I'm not quite sure what shape that will take. Maybe, Ernie, you have an idea.
There is an interesting article in a recent edition of The Economist And the title of the thing is why, you know, the sorry state of research on most things. And poorly controlled studies, inadequately assessed. And one of the things that, just what you said struck me is the fact that what is really lacking are information about things that didn't go right. You know, because something, you know, that's usually the way the world works. I got this great idea, and you try it out, and you get kicked in your rear end, and you find out, well. So I think the value of that is not so much a critique of the agencies, but maybe like saying, if you go down this road, you're going to probably run into some difficulties. So it's more the focus is more on, is there another way to do it, as opposed to, did you do any good when we, are we wasting our money on you? If there were a spirit, because I think that's the other part of evaluation, is what are the implications of something? What happens when something doesn't go right? What do you try to change? And I'd like that, a more progressive spirit in the evaluation, you know, leading towards that, those kinds of outcomes.
Good. Well, I'm going to suggest that we move on with the agenda. I hate, as I said earlier, I hate leaving this topic, but I think we've not really left it. I think we won't leave it. It's very much on our minds. And again, we appreciate so much what the staff does. But we've got these, you know, noodles in our brains that sort of, you know, we've got to do something with them. Yeah. So if it's all right with everybody, I think we'll move along now. Okay. I'd like to invite Barb to give a, I'm going to say brief report, if you don't mind.
I will make it brief.
Okay.
Yeah, and I do apologize for not having a written report. It was a little crazy.
No problem.
The last few weeks. So, yeah, just to let you know, we, and many of you are already aware, we did change the venue of our expo 12 days prior. And that was because of the new facility, not really being ready in time, so to have their permits and so on. So, but actually, Lincoln Square, we went back there. They were very accommodating, and everything worked out well. We did a lot of scurrying around to change our advertising and to make sure people knew about it. But anyway, went well. We had 92 exhibitors, which last year we had 77, so that was a big increase. 26 of them were new this year, and so that was really good, too. We estimated that probably we gave out nearly 900 of these resource books, which I want to thank Lynn for, because she did an awesome job putting this together. And I also want to encourage folks, there's a stack over there, there's a box, I have lots that we need to get out and use in the community. Every exhibitor is in here, their contact information and what kind of resources they provide. So really good thing to use throughout the year. So anyway, a rough estimate, probably 1,100 to 1,200 people came through that day. So there are evaluations that we do at the end from our exhibitors as well as our participants. And there's a summary over there. If you haven't picked those up, check those out. That gives us excellent information that we can use toward next year's planning. So we appreciate those. One of the things I continually heard was that people were really seeking information more than ever. They were talking to, they weren't just coming by to pick up the pens and the, you know, the chip clips off the tables. They were really in need of information, and that was really good to hear that a lot. So we had wonderful entertainment, and I think it particularly emphasized abilities of people, you know, with disabilities, and you know, that was awesome. They did a great job. We were able to use the hotel parking lot, thank goodness, and fit it all in. So, that's it.
Any questions for Barb?
Just a comment. I was really impressed at the number of people. It just seemed to me that there was greater groups of people around the exhibitors. And the other thing that amazed me is another venue would be great, just trying to find a parking space. I mean, is very difficult. And I kept thinking, well, given the fact that the farmer's market is open at the time, and maybe everybody's over there, but when you go into the exhibitors, it was really very crowded and a lot going on. Yeah. So I think that perhaps if that other venue becomes available next year, I would imagine there'll be even more participation.
Yeah. Well, and we do have trouble getting we're filling the place up. You know, each year we increase the number of exhibitors, and especially when you get not-for-profit exhibitors come in and they want to be able to show their equipment and so on, and it's really hard when you're dealing with a limited space. So,
Julian?
Just a comment or an observation that during the weeks leading up to this, anytime I mentioned this to someone, they almost always said, oh, you mean that thing that goes on at Lincoln Square? And that was long before it actually changed to Lincoln Square. So in some ways, it's kind of known.
Yeah.
I was surprised to hear that. So I think a lot of people were happy that it was where it's supposed to be.
Okay. Thank you ever so much. I don't know how we thank you, for all the work that you've done to bring this along, to make it more and more successful as the years go by. It's just an amazing thing, and we thank you.
Well, and, we have a wonderful steering committee many of whom are there, have been there since day one.
Yeah.
That really makes a huge difference. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Mike.
Echo Ernie in a way. I was impressed by the numbers and the energy, and that was right up to the last minute.
Yeah.
And I also had not previously appreciated, and I don't know if it had been an issue before or not, but it seemed like we were looking at Nancy's flowers and pumpkins because when I started helping to gather them up, I found out that they were going with her. So that was a marvelous effort.
Yeah.
The one concern I have, and I, to put it on local terms, it was really full of energy. It was crowded, but I didn't see any problems with it. Kind of like watching women's basketball at Huff Gym. I haven't seen the new venue, so I don't know how to make the comparison, but women's basketball at Huff Gym was a lot more energetic and exciting than women's basketball at the State Farm Center, which I have sworn never to enter, by the way.
Okay, well, now the next item is the meeting schedule for next year.
Yep, we brought this back. We had it in our July packet, Deb, and the question came up about the April meeting. So it was originally going to be April 23rd, and it was a conflict.
Okay, and so you changed it on here?
Yes, that's the main change from the previous schedule that we released. That also affected the allocation schedule on the following page.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. If any discussion of this is wanted, I'm going to suggest it be tabled till our next meeting. How's that? Otherwise, I mean, I don't think we have to approve it. We just have to say,
I'm getting hungry, so.
What?
I'm getting hungry.
Me too.
Is this a good address for a motion to adjourn?
Are there any board announcements? Yes, I'd like a motion to adjourn. Thank you, Tom, and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay.
Right.
Meeting's adjourned. Very good meeting. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. You woke me.
Anyone would have been welcome to it.
He's willing. And if he wasn't, we would have, you know.